Oh, how's everything going?
I mean, it's all right. I'm gonna try not to click on one of these cough drops that I'm sucking on, like my life depends on it, into the microphone too loud or anything. But
picked up gnarly.
No, like I feel great. Like it's definitely just allergies.
Mm.
And so like Benadryl at night is doing the job for me, except for the fact that like my whole chest is just desert dry. And so I keep having these dry hacking coughs.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, man.
Lovely.
Oh, 100%.
Dude, no,
I've never felt more attractive in my life than when I am like doubled over, wheezing, gasping, coughing all at once. It is chef's kiss.
Oh, that's funny. No. I tell you what, like with the weather being so weird, like hot and then cold and hot and then cold, everybody I know, even my kids, are having allergies in the worst way. So I don't know, man. It sucks.
For it does. Sure. It does. But if it means I get like another week or so delay onto the 110 degree temperatures that will eventually be our normal life here, I mean, I'm kind of okay with it for now.
Yeah.
Like,
that's
again,
fair.
The fact that the Benadryl is, like, knocking me out so that I actually sleep through the night instead of waking up every 45 minutes coughing or something.
True.
I feel like I can endure this.
That's fair. That's fair. I know. Our first world problems, man. Aren't they the worst?
Yeah.
All right. Let's hit intro and jump into it.
Welcome to the podcast, Blue Collar Scholars. Not long ago, a group of brilliant minds met together at a pub to discuss their unfinished works. They recognized the value of coming together around delicious beverages and having meaningful conversations. That group was known as the Inklings. The Inkledoo podcast here, we're working to be the second iteration of that group. So pour yourself a craft beverage, pull up a chair, and join the conversation.
All right, have you had anything good lately?
You know what, man? On Sunday, I ended up out in like kind of the old town Scottsdale area and did some coffee at a place called 4 Till 4.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I haven't been there yet.
It was packed when I got there.
Was there a Porsche show?
No, it was like the spillover. It was like the last day of the bike week at Westworld, apparently.
Okay.
And so, like, I got there and I was like, oh, shoot, man, this is a line. But it moved quick. And I did, like, an Americano. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, espresso and hot water. And it was good. And they had, like, this bagel with a, like, dill and feta and garlic cream cheese spread. Dude.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
And the Americano, like, it had what I would describe as kind of like a pleasant bitterness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like a dark chocolate bitterness.
Yep.
Like, and that was, yeah, man, it was a super, super nice, sip and chill. And again, the weather was actually
perfect.
Gorgeous.
For it, yeah.
Like low mid 70s and 4 Till 4. It's one of those, like, it's a little garage thing and then just a big open area. Mm-hmm. Go find a spot to chill. And yeah, man, it was exactly what a Sunday morning ought to be.
Yeah. I've been wanting to go there for a while because my boss at work is a Porsche guy.
Mm.
Right? And 4 Till 4 is a Porsche-themed coffee shop. Right? Like, all of their coffee beans are in, like, motor oil-looking type cans. You know, like, it's all themed and all Porsches. And they have, I think it's, like, first weekend of the month or last weekend of the month or something, they have a get together. It's not really like a car show, but everybody who has a Porsche comes down and hangs out at that coffee shop.
Owner's club type of thing.
Yeah, and they just line the streets with Porsches. And so he goes down there. He doesn't like coffee, but he likes Porsches. So I was like, dude, this is the place where me and you should go because I like coffee and don't care about Porsches. Hey, we can get along here. And so he's made it down there a couple of weekends, but I haven't made it down there yet. It's one I want to check out. It just seems like a cool, like, really well themed shop.
Definitely a recommend. Yeah.
Okay. Deal. Yeah. I picked up Four Peaks new Bad Birdie. Have you had that one yet? No.
I have not tried that.
Okay, so it's a juicy pale ale.
Hmm.
Okay, so I got that because the people that the house I was going over to, they like fruity beers, right? So that like mango cart, you know, like the fruit wheat beers type of thing. Like they like them on the sweet side. And so I was like, ooh, this seems like something that would be kind of happy medium, right? Because I'm not a big fruit beer person. Like they're okay, but you know, not my normal jam.
Sure.
So I got it, expecting it. When they say juicy, I was expecting like an IPA type. When you say a juicy IPA, where it's like drinking pineapple juice, you know, type of a thing, like really juicy. And it was not that. And I didn't know that. So I was a little bummed that it wasn't as juicy as I thought it would be since it was in the name. But when I was like, I couldn't remember the name for the podcast, I looked it up and they call it, you know, a crushable pale ale with hints of fruitiness. I was like, oh, and the Bad Birdie, it's a golf thing. So it's meant to be like a golf beer. So nothing crazy, nothing too much, low ABV.
All day, walking the course.
Yeah. And I didn't know, if I'd known that, I think I would have approached it differently. But like I was expecting, you know, a glass of guava juice in beer form. Not full, but you know what I mean, right? Like,
no, I know what you
really
mean.
Really juicy, and it wasn't really juicy. So they got me with the marketing, man. Jerks.
How did the people you were hanging out with, who are more kind of fruit beer
they
people?
Liked it. Yeah, okay. So they didn't have one that night. They had one the next day or a couple of days after. And they were like, ooh, this is good. And I was like, oh, man, okay. Well, I'm glad because, like, normally I buy stuff and I'm the one that, like, drinks it the next time I come over.
Right.
But, yeah, they had the, like, this is the epitome, right? They have the peach, the Four Peaks peach.
Yeah.
On tap because he has got a little kegerator. And so, like, he's got that. Like, that's, they are fruit beer people, man. They like them sweet and fruity. So it's hard for me to buy stuff to go over there because I'm always torn between, do I buy something that they will like because I know I'm going to be leaving some, or do I buy what I like and they just got to suck it up and try to enjoy something that they wouldn't normally buy? Sometimes the devil wins out. Sometimes the angel on my shoulder wins out. Like it's a pretty even battle, I think, right now.
Do you find that battle sometimes comes down to whether or not you still have some that you like left from the last time you went over there?
I haven't made it that far. So like,
So it's not an intentional thought process.
Yeah, no, not quite that intentional. I have like gone with four instead of six, knowing that they probably weren't going to like it as much. So, but it is what it is. And we're getting into summer, so that it's like all their style beer, so it'll be easier to buy like summer shandies and all that stuff. They like that stuff, so it's anywho. So next week is my first class that I'm teaching. So it is so I was actually pitching, and you brought up the idea to kind of work through my outline, and I think that's a good idea. I was really nervous about it at first, and then I started practicing, and then I felt really good about it, and that told me I was probably cocky and probably needed to come back around and look at it a little bit more.
Oh man!
But you know how it goes. That's the roller coaster. So I actually have been pitching this for a really long time at my church. I go to Copper Hills Community Church. It's a little non-denominational thing out there. Kevin, the guy who was mentoring me for a few years, he's the pastor there, and so I moved my family over there so that I could get that mentoring. And so, like most Protestant churches, they don't have a whole lot in the history and theology aspects, right? Like, they don't have a systematic theology.
Sure. But
most of them don't. They might rely, like, reference somebody else's, but really they just don't care to have a systematic theology. Which is sad, but this one has they at least have a statement of faith, right? So they have like a one page that says, hey, there's some roads that we're not going to go down. Okay. So like you can know we're pretty set on here. So they got something. And so I've actually been pushing like, hey, like, let's do like a historical theology class, and like, let's get kind of nerdy, and like, let's get some people involved in this. And, you know, it didn't get the support we were hoping for. I'm going to call him spiritual director, because that's a phrase that I know and a phrase that you know, but I don't think that's not what his title actually is.
It's not the official job title.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. He's like, but that's kind of like his role. He's the, if there was a theology guy, he would be the theology guy, but he also does a lot of like the missions and things like that. So he's not like mopping floors or restocking toilet paper. And he doesn't do a lot of like the Sunday morning preaching, right? He's kind of like the pastor to the pastors, per se.
Okay.
So he liked the idea. He's like, I agree with all of that stuff. Like, we should have these things. We didn't get the support to like start up a new class. And so what we're doing is we're going to the young adult class. So he teaches the young adults, which is, I think it's anywhere from like 20 to 35 or something like that. It's that
fairly standard range, yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, hey, why don't you come in here? Let's teach this here. Let's get some feedback. Let's figure it out a little bit and see how it goes. See if people like it. If they like it, great. Then maybe we'll have, you know, the weight behind the knuckles to go get support for like a full-on class type of thing. I was like, hey, you know what? That's a very reasonable response for me. Like, I think, you know, building some momentum, some feedback is good. Plus it gets me some reps, right? Like actually teaching it, not as like an officially sponsored advertised class, but just like a, hey, here's some random guy talking to you. And I
change his pace.
Yeah. A little less pressure, a little less everything. So, for a theological conversation. So one of the things that I'm doing is I'm switching it from an academic theology to what I'm calling it is theology as a spiritual discipline. Okay. And so the first thing on my outline, the first thing that I do is kind of define theology. And I use Jacob wrestling with God as the, like my example, like my demonstration of theology, right? Like,
sure.
The wrestling with God. You know, but you come out as Israel, but you're walking with a limp going forward. You know, like you're
right.
You are changed.
You're never going to be totally whole,
right?
But you are like changed. But there better. Is a real impact there. Yeah, no, I like that.
And so, redefining theology, and so reframing the word theology to revelation and reason. So the practice of theology as a spiritual discipline is to be presented with revelation and then using your reason to make sense of it, right? Like you have to make sense of a revelation for it to be meaningful to you, for you to use it, to identify with it, anything like that, right? Like you read the Bible, that's revelation. If you don't apply your thoughts to it at all, it won't mean anything.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really actually kind of cool framing for it. This idea that like God reveals himself, and that has to be our starting point. So like we're starting off with what God gives us, but that ultimately if we don't engage with it, it's kind of just washing over us. We're that stone in the middle of the river. Yeah. But yes, eventually over time, there will probably still be some impact just from the constant flow of the water. But like, it's a lot different than the tree at the side of the river that like the roots are in and like pulling from that water and like using it to really grow.
Yeah. And one of the things that I want to go, I don't know if this is probably just a modern thing in general, or maybe it's just a human thing in general, but the idea that just revelation just kind of like goes down in your brain, like it just like downloads, you know. And I don't know where that comes from, but like it seems like, and maybe it's a sola scriptura thing, I'm not sure, but like kind of where it's like a you're using the Bible to define the Bible and things like that. You kind of get into these circular things, and I'm like, well, but then there's this extra piece where you are there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God's word isn't going to do your thinking for you by telling you, like, in God's word that it'll go in there. Because I've had some people, like extreme solo scripture. Like,
mm-hmm.
this church isn't to that degree that I know of. But I've had some people say you're not allowed to interpret the Bible with anything other than the Bible. And I was like, man, that doesn't make sense. So you still have to interpret it, even if you're using right. other parts of the Bible to interpret it. So anyway, tangent.
No, I think that idea, there's a lot of giving us too little credit. You know, like it's kind of that false humility thing. You know, like actual humility is having the accurate sense of your strengths and your weaknesses. And then there's that like false humility that says, I am nothing. I am but a blank slate. Yes. And so I will read the scriptures and allow that scripture to transform me into something. It's like, no. God made you. You are part of revelation. You have to engage with these other parts of revelation so that you can both kind of bring out the fullness of one another.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because I've heard that those words a lot. Those have always, like, I've railed on Jeremy Camp more than once because of the, you know, his song, Take My Life, Take My Will, Take My, I was like, no, I disagree. I'm sure the heart is, I'm sure it's in the right place, but I don't like these words. But anyway, I'm going to go down a rabbit hole. I'm going to keep going because it is literally like a 2-page outline that I'm going to burn through. The next part is that I want to, and I probably need to move my outline so that it's more of a header, but I want to demonstrate like how to do theology
mm-hmm.
and using St. Thomas as the example, right? So Thomas doubts, you know, they reveal to him, hey, Christ is risen. Thomas doubts, right?
Mm-hmm.
I won't believe till I feel the holes in his side. But then the two big points that I want to bring up is that one, when he doubted, the community didn't excommunicate him. They didn't boot him, accuse him of a lack of faith, accuse him of a lack of trust.
Good.
They didn't kick him out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, Thomas doubted in community. So he did not leave the community to doubt. He, like, because with the current kind of deconstructionism, if you listen to them, they'll be like, oh, go out and just like sit on a stump by yourself and just like let everything fall off of you. And I was like, well, that's the worst thing you could do, because God will use all the people around you to help you understand things. So to leave the community when you doubt is like the surest way to be lost.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I get that there is a good time and place for some self-reflection and mm-hmm. like being on your own and doing that kind of stuff. But you're right. Like,
doubt's not one of them.
If I'm in the midst of doubt, it's kind of like being on a stormy sea. And then, well, all right, I guess I know what I'll do. I'm going to cut off from the anchor now.
Yeah.
Like, no, now is exactly why I have an anchor.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. Okay. And so I do need to bring that out because I have it as all part of like one thing. And so I see now that I need to clearly, I'm going to define, reframe theology, and then I need to frame how we're going to do theology or like mm-hmm. the rules of engagement kind of a thing and set the tone for how we're going to doubt and question and then go into the discussion question. Which is my first discussion question is, and I'm hoping I can get, because in my practice times, I'm at 40 minutes. I can stretch it to 44. So I really need about 10 minutes per discussion section, which I don't think will be difficult, especially with a question like, if you only had the Bible as you do now, would you come to the same conclusions?
Mm.
Right? And so getting them thinking about like, what would you, you know, try to get some answers, you know, and then I have written here both yes and no answers, because yes, God is, you know, the author of our faith. He's going to lead us and guide us. No, even in the Bible, they were arguing over what is the right belief, and they had to have the Council of Jerusalem, right? So there is
mm-hmm.
reasons for both, even though you had the exact same information, right? So kind of planting the seed for receiving the same revelation and coming to two different conclusions, right? And so like trying to foreshadow that a touch, and hopefully I do that successfully. But then here's where maybe I could get some feedback, because I don't know how to really transition to why I'm using a historical context, other than I think theology should just be done in a historical context because they've all done it before. And so really going from like the discussion question of, hey, if you had the Bible and you came to different conclusions, now here's a history lesson. Like, I am having trouble with that transition because, and here, let me give you the historical context. Mm-hmm. So I go from the death of the apostles, where they can resolve theological issues quickly, decisively, right? Once John dies, mm-hmm. you can't do that anymore. There's no one apostle to go to. After that, right, we have the apostolic fathers, who are disciples of the apostles. And so there is a lineage, an authoritative lineage, you can track back what they're telling you to Christ. And so they have like a level of authority there.
Right. You no longer have the eyewitnesses, but you've got the people who talked to the eyewitnesses mm-hmm. and learned from them.
Right, right. And then this is where like my bread and butter comes in, and it's Christianity versus the Gnostics. So the Gnostics are the first ones. So this is, we stretched out into Greece and we started converting Greeks, not just Jews. And so mm-hmm. now the Gnostics are like the first ones that came in with completely different belief systems, but still calling themselves Christians, right? They're like, I am a Christian, but I don't believe Christ came in human form. He was just an apparition. Whereas now we have, you know, the apostolic tradition that says, no, Christ was here in person. You know, I talked to the guy who ate food with him, mm-hmm. you know, but, and that's where I'm getting to, right? Like, two people got revelations, came to completely different conclusions, and now a third person outside of it is looking at it going, well, you say you're Christian, you believe this. You say you're Christian and you believe something different. What is right belief, right? And ultimately, the end before the final discussion question is definition of what orthodoxy is and why orthodoxy is important in this, the Gnostics being my example. So,
sure. I think what could be kind of interesting is you can even use sort of the influence of historical context in the scriptures itself. Like when you look at the Gospel of John compared to the three synoptic gospels, you know, John has the advantage of being the last of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't quite die of natural causes, but closer. He dies in exile from the burdens that come with living in exile, as opposed to being like actually actively executed.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's able to see, you know what? Okay. These Matthew, Mark, and Luke, people are reading this and it's doing a really good job of a lot of things, you know, like looking at parables and some of Jesus' teachings and things like that. Even a lot of the miracles. Cool. I don't really need to rehash that. But you know what people are missing? They're missing the fact that Jesus is not just some really good dude who God elevates. And so, man, I am going to come in and I am going to hammer hard. I am going to like really emphasize the things from my time with Jesus that showed Jesus as God and man. And you get it right away in the prologue with the, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God with God, and the Word yeah. was God.
Yeah, John was very familiar with the Greeks.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. John, and he had been seeing some of those same discussions you were talking mm-hmm. about playing out. He's like, you know what? Look, these Greeks are really good at arguing. I need to make sure that they understand the foundational starting point. And so I'm going to hammer the crap out of that. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
And like, when he doesn't give a whole lot of miracle accounts. I think it's something like 7 in the entire Gospel of John. And they're all called signs. Because again, he wants to drive home the point. This isn't just about Jesus showing off his power. He is pointing to something when he does this.
Mm.
He is pointing to his divinity. He is pointing to his mission. He is pointing to who he is. And so, like, you can use that kind of historical context and be like, so if we see that in the development of the scriptures, and then you see it again in Paul's letters, especially the ones where he's got to write multiple letters to the same churches. Like, he's having to go back to some of the same problems in the churches, but the churches are developing and they're hitting new stumbling blocks. And so St. Paul is addressing new things. And it's important for us to understand, like, the advantage to historical context is we can know when a question's been answered and when it's a question that we need to answer. So we don't just keep trying to reinvent the wheel over and over and over again. Like, you know why I don't have to argue with a Gnostic? Because John wrote his gospel.
Right.
I don't have to, like, argue about whether or not Jesus was actually God, because John laid that one out for me. You know? I don't have to wonder about my obligation to the poor. Because in Luke's gospel, he makes it really clear. Blessed are the poor. Woe to those who are rich. Ooh, okay. Got it. Gotta keep my eyes out. And so we're able to then settle into our part in Revelation, in our part in theology, which is looking at the truths are eternal. The context is not. I am in a new context now. The example I use with my students all the time is, hey, what did Jesus say about the use of nuclear weapons?
Right.
And the answer at first is nothing. And it's like, really? So you don't think any of that stuff about, like, loving your neighbor and taking care of the poorest and the weakest, you don't think that has any bearing on the use of nuclear weapons? Because again, those are truths that are eternal. Jesus didn't mention nuclear weapons because they weren't an issue at the time. Our job in that historical context is to be like, okay, here are the eternal truths given to us in scriptures. Here I am in the United States, a place that isn't mentioned in the Bible. In the year 2024, a year that isn't mentioned in the Bible. Dealing with Republicans and Democrats, two things that aren't mentioned in the Bible. Battling over dollars, which are not a thing that are mentioned in the Bible. How do I apply those truths to now? And that's where this historical context comes into play. It's like, okay, I've got to know what were the questions being asked then, what's the same about them, what's different about them. And then going back to what you were talking about earlier, that communal aspect, the humility to say, I'm not going to answer all those questions on my own. I'm going to talk to my people. I've got a bunch of other people in a similar context trying to apply those same universal truths. We're going to work together on this crap and we're going to knock it out.
Yeah, I like that because it, as a spirit, especially looking to it as a spiritual discipline, like if we were looking to it as an academic, I would say, no, go do all of the really heavy lifting. But for from a spiritual discipline perspective, meaning Joe Schmo, who's building faith type of a thing, relying on letting history do the heavy work so that basically you can say this truth has been determined or discovered. Now I just need to apply it to today. Like, I don't have to confirm the truth. Like, I don't have to go rebuttal every single argument and review every single argument regarding this and that. I can just kind of see, stand on, I always say that we stand on the shoulders of giants when it comes to this stuff, because especially like the Apostolic Fathers into the Apologists, like they did huge work, like big, heavy lifting as people were killing them, you know, like, so the heart of theology is in that time. And so we don't have to do that. We just kind of have to take the gift that they gave us and how does that apply now when I'm driving down a freeway in a Prius, not walking down a dirt road with a Roman chasing me with a sword, you know, like.
Yeah. The context has shifted slightly.
Yes. Yeah. 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 A little different.
What counts as a pressing question is a lot different today than it was.
Right. I like that. And I yeah, I appreciate that because I had that's the thought in my brain, articulating it has been hard, and not just articulating it, but like as I'm like saying it out loud in my practice, that transition is just like, you know, like when you don't see a speed bump and you're just like, oh crap. Okay, I'm on a different road now. That's what it's been. That's what my practice has been like. We're like, oh, this is nice and smooth. And then there's this like clunk clunk. And then now we're talking about history. And so it's really been that transition has been the hardest, because getting into the conclusion even has been easy, because I feel like the outline actually builds towards the importance of theology as a spiritual discipline, because, and this is going to be my life lesson, is that we have to wrestle with these things, because how do we know what's right? Like, if two people can come to the same conclusions with the same revelation, then what are we supposed to do with that, right? Like, we have to, as you've said, engage with these things, and I hope that the outline brings them to that conclusion, brings all of us to that conclusion that, hey, I can't just accept these things. I need to wrestle with them as well, so that when I'm holding on to something, I know I did the best I could with what I had, and I didn't just bury my talent in the sand waiting for the master to return.
I think that's really good, man. I think that's really good. And, you know, again, it's also that idea of, if I haven't tested my anchor prior to a storm, like when I'm in calm waters, if I haven't dropped the anchor, how am I going to have the confidence when the storm comes to really count on that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, like, in the context of a community where, not that we always agree with each other, but where we trust the intentions of one another and we believe we're all aiming for the same thing, that is a safe place for some conflict to occur. You and I, if we have an argument, and we have, if we have an argument about something, that's awesome, because I know I can count on the fact that as you're pushing me on something, it's because you desire my good that you're pushing for it. And if you were to see it starting to like fray and like break where I'm at, you would pull back, because that's not the goal. You're not here to destroy.
Right.
And so our ideas, our beliefs have the opportunity to steel on steel sharpen one another, knowing that we're not going to break them. That way, when I do find myself in a conversation with someone who is looking to undermine and undercut my faith, who their goal is actually to make me doubt everything that I've ever believed, I can have confidence that this is not a brittle weapon I wield. This is a living faith. And so I think that's, you know, for me, that's kind of the life lesson and the importance of community, is that idea, you know, like the animal documentaries about like the lion cubs and stuff who like play maul each other before they become like actual hunters. You know, we need that opportunity to practice our reason, to engage our minds with revelation in a supportive environment before we attempt to test ourselves in a hostile one. And like that ability to discern the truth of God's revelation in community helps not only from that perspective, but also from the expanded perspective of like, I can only see things one way on my own. I need your perspective to catch the angles that are like off out of my periphery. You know, we need each other to get a closer to the full picture.
Right.
Because that's a great thing, is God is infinite. We're not going to figure him out. And so like, there is plenty of room for us to bring different insights in and build those together and see where they bring us.
Yeah. Agreed. I like that. How do you feel about reviewing day two? So I'm doing two classes, and I got, so this one, do you want to do the next, look at the next outline next week?
I love that idea, man.
Okay, cool.
I think that'd be great.
Let's do that. And then I get to record it, so hopefully I'll be able to pull it in and edit it and host it here. So we'll see how it goes. And you can see if I wrap up my 60-minute speech in, like, you know, 15 minutes because I'm nervous and speak at 100 miles an hour. But either way, it'll be entertaining. You know, it'll either be a good talk or really funny. One of the two. We'll see.
Nah, man, you've got this. Could I ain't even both. Worried. Not going to sweat it.
Right on. All right, you got anything else on your brain, man?
Nah, man, I'm good.
All right on. With that, we will say
adieu.